So for 35 years, if you wanted to sit on the most beautiful, pristine, sandy beach in Whatcom County, Washington, you basically had to pack your cooler, grab your kids by the hand, and play like a real-life high-stakes game of Frogger.
Yeah, literally Frogger with freight trains, though.
Right. You had to physically dodge massive Burlington Northern Santa Fe locomotives just to touch the sand.
It's intense. I mean, running across an active train track on a blind curve.
It is. And that's really the core of what we're getting into today. We are exploring that massive gap between the serene illusion of nature and the brutal, logistical, sometimes terrifying reality of actually engaging with it.
Which is such an important distinction. We culturally apply this sort of, well, resort logic to our wild spaces,
But
right?
totally.
Like you see a photograph of a sunset over a calm saltwater bay on social media, and you subconsciously assume there's a paved parking lot and a visitor center just out of the frame.
Yes, like the infrastructure just naturally exists to support your vacation.
Exactly. But the landscape doesn't care about our convenience. It operates on its own topographical terms, its own tidal terms.
Right.
And when you strip away that curated aesthetic, you find an environment that actively resists casual consumption.
And that resistance is the entire mission of our deep dive today. We are heading up to the Pacific Northwest, specifically to Larrabee State Park.
A beautiful spot.
It really is. It sits about 7 miles south of Bellingham. It's right on the edge of the continent where the steep slopes of Chuckanut Mountain drop like at a near 90-degree angle straight into the salt water of Samish Bay.
It's dramatic topography.
Super dramatic. So we are going to build a comprehensive boots-on-the-ground manual for understanding this park.
No sugarcoating.
None at all. We're getting into the mechanics of its sandstone tide pools, the miles of vertical trails, the unforgiving lunar cycles, and the very harsh realities of parking and logistics there.
And the material guiding our analysis today is actually incredibly candid.
Yeah.
We're utilizing a detailed regional breakdown written by Gennaro Schaffer.
He's a local Whatcom County real estate broker, right?
Yeah, exactly. And he utilizes Larrabee State Park as the ultimate environmental litmus test for his clients.
I love this concept so much.
Right. When prospective buyers tell him they want to move to the Bellingham area to embrace the quote-unquote rugged outdoor lifestyle, he takes them to Larrabee to see if they actually comprehend the friction that lifestyle requires.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because my working hypothesis reading his guide is that most real estate literature is pure fantasy.
Oh, 100%.
It's designed to sell a dream, like the seamless transition from your living room to a kayak. But this source reads more like a survival manual for a Saturday in July.
It really
I
does.
mean, he's detailing vanishing boat ramps, impossible parking geometries, sheer cliffs. It feels like he's actively trying to talk people out of buying property here. Why is a broker giving us the harsh realities?
Well, he's trying to establish environmental literacy. Selling someone a multi-million-dollar architectural masterpiece on a cliff overlooking Samish Bay is a disaster if that buyer doesn't understand the hydrology of a steep slope drain field
Oh, wow.
or, the reality of winter rockfall.
Yeah.
Mastering a landscape like the Chuckanut Corridor isn't just about knowing its GPS coordinates.
Right. It's about the mechanics of the land.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How it functions under stress. He is laying out the operational parameters of the mountain.
And the very reason Chuckanut Drive was built as a cliffside highway in the first place is because of that aggressive, sheer topography.
It's carved right into the rock.
Yeah. And to understand why this specific stretch of roughly 2,700 acres is the keystone to the region's entire outdoor identity, we really have to look at the bedrock of its history.
We do.
Because Larrabee isn't just a park, it is the flagship. It actually holds the title of Washington's very first state park.
And the origin of that title reveals a lot about our shifting relationship with the outdoors. I mean, back in 1915, Washington's governor, Ernest Lister, initiated this push to acquire small, scenic tracts of land.
But not for conservation, right?
No, not at all. This wasn't driven by some deep ecological awakening or a desire to preserve biodiversity.
Right. It was entirely driven by the combustion engine.
Exactly, the automobile.
An automobile was radically altering human mobility in 1915. You had the Pacific Highway, which eventually became the backbone of Highway 99, and it had just been designated around 1913.
So car culture is just exploding.
Right. And this old winding logging road hugging the coast, known as Chuckanut Drive, was being aggressively lobbied into becoming a state-funded scenic highway.
People wanted a pretty drive.
Yeah. And Governor Lister essentially just wanted picturesque pullouts where motorists could, like, cool their radiators and stretch their legs after wrestling early automobiles around blind coastal curves.
Because the infrastructure of recreation always follows the infrastructure of transit.
That's a great way to put it.
The creation of the park was just a byproduct of car culture. So to secure the land for that roadside stop, the state looked to the Larrabee family.
Specifically, Charles Xavier Larrabee, right.
Yeah, he had been a prominent figure in the nearby town of Fairhaven. And crucially, he had been one of the loudest political champions for turning that rugged logging road into a proper highway.
Okay, so he's a huge advocate for the road.
Very much so. But after his death on November 22, 1915, his widow, Frances Larrabee, donated 20 acres of land to the Washington Board of Park Commissioners.
And they initially called it Chuckanut State Park, borrowing the indigenous term for the bay it overlooked.
Which is an important detail.
Yeah, the source is very clear to contextualize this. Labeling it the first state park in 1915 is a strictly bureaucratic, settler-era milestone.
Right. We're talking about Coast Salish territory.
Exactly. The land and the shoreline had been actively utilized, managed, and inhabited by Native peoples for millennia before a deed was ever signed or a Model T ever drove past.
That framing is essential. The state essentially drew a line on a map and claimed a Genesis point, but they were simply overlaying a new recreational management structure onto an ancient, deeply established human and ecological landscape.
Right.
And that management structure quickly sought to consolidate its own prestige. Because in 1923, the state decided to rename the park from Chuckanut to Larrabee State Park.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting to me. The source notes, she actively objected to her name being on it, but the state did it anyway.
Yeah. Frances Larrabee explicitly opposed it.
It's like throwing a surprise party for someone who explicitly told you they hate surprises. Why do you think history steamrolled her preference?
Well, the institutional ego required a monument.
Ah, okay.
A family name like Larrabee carries weight, and the state leveraged that weight to justify future expansions. The state park system was in its absolute infancy. Attaching the name of a wealthy, highly influential local family lent the entire governmental enterprise a sheen of legitimacy.
They steamrolled her modesty for their own political capital.
Precisely. And those expansions were massive. By 1937, the Larrabee family facilitated the donation of another massive tract of land, ballooning the park from a tiny 20-acre pullout to the roughly 2,748-acre wilderness preserve it is today.
But the land itself was far too rugged for casual public use without serious intervention, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Which brings us to the Great Depression. In the mid-1930s, the federal government stepped in with Works Progress Administration, or WPA, funding.
Right. The New Deal era.
The source cites roughly $30,000 flowing into the park in 1936. And we aren't just talking about planting trees here. This was heavy, manual infrastructure development.
The labor mechanics of the WPA era permanently altered the park's topography. You had crews of men utilizing hand tools, crosscut saws, and early pneumatic drills to carve water systems and playground footprints out of solid coastal bedrock.
Literally carving dead rock.
Yeah. And in 1935, they physically bored a railroad underpass to allow safe vehicular movement beneath the heavy freight lines.
Wow.
Then in 1944, an architect named Earl E. McCannell designed the park's distinctive amphitheater and band shell. They were civilizing the wild, applying geometric order to the forest floor.
And all that historical infrastructure, all that carving, was in service of getting people closer to the edge of the continent?
To the water.
Exactly. The defining feature of Larrabee is that interface between the mountain and the sea. The park boasts about 8,100 feet of saltwater shoreline.
It's massive.
And our real estate broker states he sends first-time visitors here over a dozen other local municipal parks, specifically because of the unique geology of that shoreline.
Yeah, the geological star of that shoreline is found at Wildcat Cove. This is the domain of Chuckanut Sandstone.
Which is visually so striking.
It really is. The shoreline isn't composed of your standard smooth river rocks or sheer granite. It is deeply pocketed, honeycombed, and swirled.
Let's actually unpack the mechanism of those honeycomb shapes, because it looks like someone took an ice cream scoop to the side of a cliff.
It does.
How does solid sandstone end up looking like Swiss cheese?
Okay, so the technical term for that specific type of geological weathering is tephoni.
Tephoni.
Right. And it's driven by a process called haloclasty, which is essentially salt weathering.
Okay, salt weathering.
Yeah. Samish Bay is a saltwater environment subject to heavy wave action and sea spray. The Chuckanut sandstone is naturally porous.
So it absorbs the water.
Exactly. When the ocean sprays onto the cliffs, the salt water seeps into the microscopic pores of the rock. Then, when the tide retreats and the sun hits the rock, the water evaporates, but it leaves the microscopic salt molecules behind.
Oh, wait, so the salt crystallizes inside the rock itself?
Precisely. And as those salt crystals grow over time, they exert immense mechanical pressure from within the pore.
That is wild.
They literally pry the rock apart from the inside out, popping off individual grains of sand one by one.
Just grain by grain.
Grain by grain. Over decades and centuries, this microscopic exfoliation carves out those massive, swirling, cavernous pockets.
And those cavernous pockets are what make the tide pools at Wildcat Cove so vibrant.
Oh, they're perfect for it.
They create these perfect, sheltered microenvironments that hold water when the ocean recedes. You end up with these miniature, self-contained, Salish sea ecosystems right at your feet, packed with sea stars, barnacles, crabs, and anemones.
But Wildcat Cove is only half of the shoreline story.
Right.
The other premier destination is Clayton Beach, and this is where we return to the terrifying logistical reality we mentioned at the start.
The Frogger situation.
The Frogger situation. Clayton Beach is highly coveted because it is one of the very few genuinely sandy beaches in the entire Chuckanut Corridor.
Which is rare up there.
Very rare. So the state of Washington recognized its value and acquired a 100-acre parcel there back in 1988.
But owning the land and accessing the land are two completely different legal realities.
Completely different.
Between the parking lot and that beautiful sandy beach sits the Burlington Northern Santa Fe rail line.
The main line.
And for 35 years, from 1988 until 2023, there was no bridge. You had to scramble down a dirt path, step onto active train tracks on a blind curve, listen for a horn, and run.
And you have to understand, the delay wasn't merely a lack of funding. It was a collision of jurisdictional authorities.
It's never just money.
Right. Railroads in the United States operate under incredibly powerful, federally protected rights of way that date back to the 19th century. A right of way isn't just the physical steel tracks. It is a legally impenetrable corridor.
So the state couldn't just build over it?
No. A state park agency cannot simply paint a crosswalk over a BNSF mainline. Constructing a pedestrian overpass requires navigating millions of dollars in engineering studies, liability negotiations, airspace rights, and structural designs.
And they have to clear those double-stacked commercial freight cars moving at high speeds.
Exactly. It's a massive undertaking.
It is the ultimate example of the friction we are talking about. It took 3.5 decades to finally open a safe, fenced pedestrian bridge in 2023.
A huge milestone.
Huge. You park at the Lost Lake lot, hike a 3/4-mile trail through the woods, cross the massive new overpass, and drop down to the sand. But even with the bridge, the physical toll is substantial.
Oh, for sure.
The source has this great line. He says, "The walk down is easy. The walk back up with kids and beach gear is the part nobody photographs."
It's so true.
It sounds like going to this beach is a bit of a reverse IKEA trip, like easy to get into, a grueling workout to get out of. Do people romanticize these beaches too much?
I think so. He is highlighting the fundamental physics of a coastal ravine. You are descending hundreds of vertical feet from the highway to sea level.
Right.
Gravity is doing the work on the way down. But when you are sunbaked, dehydrated, and carrying heavy coolers, wet towels, and exhausted toddlers, that 3/4-mile return trip up the gravel switchbacks and staircases is a grueling aerobic threshold test.
It perfectly proves the point about applying resort logic to wild spaces. People see sand on a map, and their brain instantly expects a flat paved walkway to a parking garage.
And an ice cream stand.
Exactly. Larrabee forces you to pay a physical tax for the amenity of the sand, and there are strict behavioral taxes as well.
Rules are rules.
The broker reminds visitors that because it is a protected state park environment, dogs must be kept on a leash no longer than 8 feet, and fires are strictly prohibited outside of designated zones. The beach is a highly managed biological asset.
And while the park rules dictate your behavior, if you want to actually touch the water, your schedule is dictated by celestial mechanics.
I love this part.
The lunar cycle controls every single amenity on the shoreline.
Let's look at the sheer logistical puzzle of trying to have a day at the bay. You have two primary water-based activities at Larrabee: exploring the sandstone tide pools and launching a small motorized boat from the Wildcat Cove boat ramp to go fishing or crabbing.
And you have to consult a tide chart before you even put your keys in the ignition.
Seriously.
The broker states explicitly that the sandstone tide pools at Wildcat Cove and Clayton Beach are exclusively visible at a low tide. and ideally a low minus tide.
I want to clarify the mechanics of a minus tide because it isn't just a regular low tide.
No, it's extreme.
We are talking about the gravitational alignment of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun. When the Sun and the Moon align during a full or new moon, their combined gravitational pull creates spring tides,
right,
which result in the highest highs and the lowest lows. And because the bathymetry, the underwater topography of Samish Bay, is incredibly shallow and sloping, a vertical drop of just a few inches in the water level translates to hundreds of yards of horizontal water retreat.
The ocean physically pulls back to reveal the seafloor. Without a minus tide, the honeycomb sandstone and the sea stars are buried beneath feet of opaque cold salt water. You see nothing.
So you do your homework, you check the chart, you see a minus tide is peaking at 2:00 p.m. on a Saturday.
Perfect timing.
You pack your tide pool shoes and you decide you'll also hook up your boat trailer to use the Wildcat Cove boat launch while you were there.
And this is where the topography mathematically defeats you.
Yes.
The Wildcat Cove boat launch is built into that same incredibly shallow coastal slope. It is entirely non-functional at low tide.
Wait, so we have a boat launch that literally stops working twice a day.
Twice a day, it's useless.
That's like having a driveway that vanishes into a sinkhole every afternoon. If it's that shallow, is it even a viable amenity, or is it just a trap for tourists towing a Boston Whaler?
It's the bathtub analogy.
Yeah.
It's like trying to float a plastic toy boat in a bathtub that has a very long, gradual slope at one end.
Okay.
When the tub is full, the water reaches the edge. But if you drain even a quarter of the water, the waterline recedes massively down the slope, leaving half the tub completely dry.
So if you show up to launch your boat at a minus tide,
the concrete ramp ends in a vast expanse of sticky mud.
Mm.
You are stranded.
A visitor really must possess precise environmental literacy. The boat launch is only usable during the narrow window of high tide. The tide pools are only accessible during the narrow window of a minus tide.
They are mutually exclusive.
Therefore, if you plan a trip to execute both activities on the same afternoon, you are mathematically doomed to fail. You cannot force the ocean to accommodate your itinerary.
And the ocean doesn't just dictate the water levels, you know. It dictates what you're legally allowed to consume.
Oh, this is the scary part.
People look at Samish Bay and they see an endless buffet of clams, oysters, and Dungeness crab. But the source issues a severe, non-negotiable warning about foraging.
Yeah, you must check the Washington State Department of Health biotoxin map.
Specifically looking for closures related to paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP.
PSP is an acute, life-threatening reality in the Pacific Northwest. It is caused by microscopic, single-celled marine organisms called dinoflagellates.
Right, specifically a species known as Alexandrium.
Under certain temperature and nutrient conditions, these dinoflagellates bloom in massive numbers.
And the critical biological mechanism here is how the bivalves interact with the bloom.
The clams and oysters.
Exactly. Clams, oysters, and mussels are filter feeders. They pump gallons of seawater through their bodies every day to extract plankton.
Right.
When they filter the Alexandrium, they absorb its naturally occurring defense chemical, which is called saxitoxin.
And the fascinating and dangerous evolutionary quirk is that the shellfish are completely immune to the saxitoxin.
It doesn't bother them at all.
They possess a slight genetic mutation in their cellular pathways that prevents the toxin from binding to their nerves. So the clam simply bioaccumulates massive concentrations of the neurotoxin in its tissue, perfectly healthy and oblivious.
But human beings do not have that mutation.
We definitely do not.
When a human eats that clam, the saxitoxin binds immediately to the voltage-gated sodium channels in our nerve cells.
That sounds bad.
It blocks the electrical signals from your brain to your muscles. It causes numbness, tingling, and in severe cases, total respiratory paralysis.
And the most terrifying part, saxitoxin is highly heat stable.
You cannot cook it out.
Boiling the clam does absolutely nothing to neutralize the poison.
Which is why the state monitors the water so aggressively and shuts down harvest areas instantly. The broker's warning is literal. He says this is one of those rules that exists for a real reason. It is not something to gamble on.
If you want the romantic Pacific Northwest experience of eating fresh shellfish on the bay without playing Russian roulette with your nervous system, the broker offers the perfect logistical pivot.
Yes, a much safer option.
You drive south out of the park along Chuckanut Drive to the town of Bow. There, you find Taylor Shellfish Farms and their Samish Oyster Bar.
It's a great spot.
It is a commercial, heavily regulated aquaculture operation right on the water where you can safely buy oysters, get a shucking lesson, and utilize their shoreline barbecues.
It represents a necessary retreat from the rugged unpredictability of Larrabee. You engage with the difficult, tide-dependent wilderness in the morning, and you utilize the curated, scientifically monitored commercial amenity in the afternoon.
So let's say the tides are entirely against you. The water is high, the tide pools are submerged, but you didn't bring a boat to use the launch. Your entire shoreline itinerary is washed out. Where do you go?
You turn around.
You turn your back to the sea and you look up. You engage with the vertical park.
Chuckanut Mountain rises sharply from the water, and the park maintains a highly structured network of trails on its seaward face.
We are looking at roughly 18 total miles of trails, right?
Yeah, and they're strictly segmented by use. The state has designated about 1.5 miles exclusively for bicycles, 2.7 miles exclusively for hikers, and 13.8 miles of multi-use trail.
Which creates a significant draw for the regional mountain biking community.
Huge draw. But the undisputed classic of the park is the Fragrance Lake Trail. The trailhead sits right off the narrow shoulder of Chuckanut Drive.
But the broker highlights a hilarious, incredibly common modern frustration here. You cannot get a straight answer on how long the hike actually is.
The data discrepancy across digital mapping platforms is stark.
It really is.
The Washington Trails Association, which is the gold standard for regional trail data, logs the Fragrance Lake round trip at exactly 4.0 miles with 1,260 feet of vertical elevation gain.
Okay.
However, if you look at third-party GPS tracking apps like AllTrails or Strava, they often log it closer to 4.4 miles with only 1,060 feet of gain.
I find it fascinating that our hyper-advanced satellite technology gets confused by a dirt path.
Well, if you look at the mechanics of the trail, it makes perfect sense.
How so?
The Fragrance Lake Trail is a series of tight, relentless switchbacks climbing through dense, towering canopies of second-growth and old-growth Douglas firs. A GPS receiver strapped to your wrist is trying to triangulate a signal from satellites in low Earth orbit.
Right.
That dense evergreen canopy creates signal interference. And the tight, repetitive zigzags of the switchbacks cause the GPS track to smooth out the corners, dropping distance, and miscalculating the barometric pressure changes for elevation.
So the app basically cuts the corners.
Exactly. Regardless of what the algorithm tells you, your quadriceps will tell you it is a strenuous, sustained aerobic climb.
I bet.
The payoff comes in two stages, though. About a mile into the ascent, there's a short spur trail that breaks off toward the cliff edge, delivering a sweeping, elevated panoramic view over the San Juan Islands.
And the final payoff is Fragrance Lake itself, sitting quietly in a high-elevation depression on the mountain. It features a flat, 0.6-mile loop trail wrapping around the water, bordered by massive, glacial, erratic boulders covered in thick moss.
Sounds idyllic.
And it smells exactly like its name, that heavy, damp, almost spicy scent of decaying evergreen needles and wet earth.
For hikers seeking a higher threshold of endurance, the trail network continues upward. Bypassing Fragrance Lake and pushing toward Lost Lake adds an additional 5.5 miles and over 800 more feet of climbing, according to the WTA.
That's a serious hike.
Executing the dual lake circuit as an out and back from the highway transforms a casual morning walk into a severe all-day physical commitment.
And the trail system doesn't end at the park boundaries either. Larrabee is physically tethered back to the urban environment. The interurban trail is a 6.6 mile, mostly flat, crushed gravel path constructed on an abandoned railway grade.
It links the dense wilderness of Larrabee straight north into the historic neighborhoods of Fairhaven,
connecting to urban trailheads at Arroyo Park and Fairhaven Park.
It creates a seamless corridor of human movement. But right as you begin to romanticize this vast, interconnected, untouched emerald wilderness, the real estate broker shatters the illusion with a vital piece of context.
Yes, this was wild.
Larrabee is an active working forest.
This raises a major red flag for me. I'm driving an hour to go hiking, and I find my trailhead is a logging site. How do we reconcile state park with timber operation? It feels like showing up to a wellness retreat and finding a bulldozer in the Zen garden.
I know. The concept of a working forest inside a state park seems entirely paradoxical. You expect a state park to be a preserved museum exhibit under glass.
Exactly.
But the broker warns that the Washington State Parks Department actively runs large-scale logging operations and heavy machinery forest thinning projects right alongside the recreation trails.
To understand why a state park would authorize chainsaws, you have to look at the ecological history of the land, right?
You do. The pristine old-growth forest that once covered Chuckanut Mountain was aggressively clear-cut during the logging booms of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. What grew back is a second-growth forest.
And second-growth forests don't grow back with natural spacing.
No, they don't.
They grow back incredibly dense, like weeds choking a garden. Millions of small trees compete for the same sunlight and soil.
Exactly. This creates a severe structural vulnerability. The dense, overcrowded trees become stressed, making them highly susceptible to root rot, disease, and insect infestations.
Which is bad enough.
But more critically, that extreme density creates an explosive fuel load. If a wildfire sparks in an unmanaged, overcrowded second-growth forest on a steep slope, it burns with catastrophic intensity.
So the logging isn't for commercial timber profit.
No.
It is aggressive, preventative landscaping. The state is utilizing industrial machinery to thin out the weaker trees, open up the canopy, and artificially replicate the spacing of a healthy, old-growth ecosystem.
But the logistical reality for the visitor is brutal.
I mean, the noise alone.
The broker notes, he has literally driven out-of-town friends up the mountain for a highly anticipated hike to Lost Lake, only to find the trailhead barricaded with yellow tape and the sound of heavy diesel feller bunchers echoing through the woods.
That would be so disappointing.
He urges every visitor to check the park's digital alert page before leaving their driveway. The wilderness here is a managed, dynamic, sometimes industrial worksite.
Navigating the closures, the tides, and the trail mileage requires significant mental bandwidth.
A lot of planning.
If a visitor successfully manages all of that and decides they want to spend the night under the Douglas firs, they are met with the most intense logistical choke point of all.
The campsite reservation system.
The infrastructure to support overnight stays is actually highly developed. The TARC maintains 51 standard tent sites, 26 utility sites featuring full RV hookups for water and electricity, 8 primitive hike-in sites, 6 coin-operated showers, a sanitary dump station, and 2 specific ADA-compliant sites.
That specific ratio of site types, hookups, versus primitive highlights the modern commodification of outdoor recreation.
How so?
Well, because Larrabee offers such a concentrated diversity of topographical features, the mountain trails, the freshwater lakes, the saltwater boat launch, it attracts wildly disparate demographics simultaneously.
Oh, I see. You have the retiree in a $500,000 luxury motor coach requiring 50 amp electrical service, parked just a few hundred yards away from a hardcore minimalist sleeping on a foam pad in the dirt.
Exactly. They are entirely different ecosystems of recreation forced to compete for the exact same acreage of real estate.
And that competition has eradicated the concept of spontaneity.
Completely. The broker details a timeline that shocks his out-of-state clients. You cannot impulsively decide on a Thursday in July that you want to camp at Larrabee on Friday.
Not going to happen.
The Washington State Parks reservation system opens 9 months in advance.
9 months.
For the peak operational window, mid-May through mid-September, the sites are booked the instant the digital window opens.
You literally have to conceive a child and book a campsite at Larrabee on the exact same day, then they'll both arrive at the same time.
That is painfully accurate.
What does this say about our modern relationship with the outdoors? Are we losing the ability to just go for a drive?
We might be.
Yeah.
The psychological implications of that are staggering. You are required to possess the foresight of a corporate supply chain manager just to sleep in a tent.
Yes.
You are booking a patch of dirt in August for an experience that won't happen until the following May. We haven't escaped the suffocating spreadsheet planning of modern urban life. We have actively projected it onto the forest.
The friction of access has become a barrier to entry, and that friction extends to the financial mechanics of visiting the park, too.
The Discover Pass.
Right. The state requires a Discover Pass for any vehicle parked on state recreation lands.
And the broker is very explicit about how this functions. There is no toll booth at Larrabee where you hand $5 to a ranger.
No convenient little shack.
The Discover Pass is a statewide permit. It currently costs $10 for a single-day use, or $45 for an annual pass. He strongly advises his clients to purchase the annual pass if they plan to recreate more than 4 times a year, as it covers everything from Larrabee to Birch Bay State Park further north.
The one logistical reprieve is granted to the people who survive the 9-month reservation gauntlet. If you secure a paid overnight camping site, your vehicle is automatically exempt from the Discover Pass requirement for the duration of your stay.
Which is nice. But for the day tripper who just bought their $10 pass online, arriving at the park presents a terrifying infrastructural failure.
Like at parking.
The parking. The broker paints a vivid picture of a sunny summer weekend. By mid-morning, the primary parking zones, the Fragrance Lake lot and the Lost Lake lot that services the Clayton Beach Bridge, are completely saturated.
When the designated asphalt is full, human desperation takes over, right?
Yeah, and visitors begin improvising parking solutions along the shoulder of the highway.
Which brings us back to the sheer geometry of Chuckanut Drive. We are talking about a two-lane road carved out of sandstone, featuring blind, hairpin curves, minimal shoulders, and a speed limit that cars routinely ignore.
The physics of the situation are lethal. You have a family of four unloading beach chairs from the driver's side of an SUV, standing inches from a lane of traffic where vehicles are rounding a blind curve at 45 miles an hour.
That is terrifying.
The sight lines are virtually non-existent. The broker's directive is uncompromising. Do not park on the highway shoulder. If you arrive at 1:00 p.m. on a Saturday in August, you are not going to enjoy a hike.
What are you going to do?
You are going to spend 90 minutes orbiting a full parking lot in a state of escalating road rage.
So if the peak summer weekend is mathematically broken, how do you successfully interface with this landscape?
The broker provides the ultimate local hack. You manipulate the calendar.
Okay, I like that.
The optimal Larrabee experience requires threading a very specific temporal needle. The broker outlines the perfect execution, a quiet weekday morning, in the shoulder seasons of May or September.
Right, because the public schools are in session, neutralizing the family crowds.
Exactly. The forest canopy is lush, the asphalt lots are empty. You have cross-referenced your tide chart to ensure your arrival perfectly synchronizes with a low minus tide, exposing the sandstone honeycombs. And your Discover Pass is already displayed on your dashboard.
It is a meticulously engineered moment of serenity. But the Pacific Northwest isn't always sunny and serene. What happens when the axis of the Earth tilts and winter arrives?
The operational rhythm of the park constricts. The physical gates, which open at 6:30 a.m. in the summer, don't unlock until 8:00 a.m. in the winter, and they close at dusk, which arrives depressingly early in December.
The broker actually champions the winter experience, though, noting the moody, isolated atmosphere of storm watching on the beach.
It is beautiful in its own way.
But the commute becomes an obstacle course. Chuckanut Drive in December is a gauntlet of black ice in the shaded curves, severe wind events whipping off Samish Bay, and the very real hazard of heavy rocks detaching from the freezing and thawing sandstone cliffs above and plummeting onto the roadway.
Which serves as the perfect transition into the broker's ultimate thesis. Everything we have discussed, the tides, the trails, the rocks, the traffic, is the reality of visiting.
Right.
But his guide is written for people evaluating the reality of living permanently in the Chuckanut Corridor or the adjacent Fairhaven and Edgemoor neighborhoods.
The real estate profile here is wholly unique. You are not browsing subdivisions of identical tract housing with municipal sidewalks.
Not at all.
The inventory consists of highly customized architectural homes built directly into the steep forested slopes, engineered specifically to frame those multi-million dollar views of the San Juan Islands.
The allure is intoxicating. I mean, the marketing pitch is that you can finish a Zoom call in your living room and be standing in a pristine coastal tide pool 12 minutes later.
That sounds like a dream.
But the broker demands his clients confront the concept of vocation versus vacation.
So to get that pristine view of the San Juans from your living room, you're basically taking on the responsibilities of a park ranger. Managing slope stability and wildfire risk. Is buying a home here less about real estate and more about buying into a high-maintenance relationship with the mountain itself?
It absolutely is the exact geological and botanical features that make Larrabee breathtaking to visit for 4 hours on a Saturday. Mm. The sheer vertical drops, the massive ancient trees, the isolation are the exact same factors that make owning a home there an exercise in constant expensive anxiety.
The infrastructural trade-offs are immense. Because these homes are integrated into a rugged mountain face, they are frequently disconnected from municipal utility grids.
Yeah, let's dive deep into the mechanics of that, starting with the septic systems. You cannot just flush a toilet and let the city handle it. You are responsible for your own private wastewater treatment. A septic system relies on a drain field, a large area of porous soil designed to naturally filter the liquid effluent before it reaches the groundwater.
But Chuckanut Mountain is solid sandstone bedrock covered by only a thin, fragile layer of glacial till and topsoil, and it is pitched at a severe angle.
Exactly. Gravity is relentless. If you dump hundreds of gallons of wastewater into a drain field on a 30-degree slope that receives massive amounts of Pacific Northwest winter rainfall, the soil becomes completely saturated.
It turns to soup.
It loses in structural cohesion. If hydrology isn't engineered flawlessly, your drain field doesn't just fail, it physically detaches from the bedrock and slides down the mountain into Samish Bay, potentially taking the structural foundation of your home with it.
You are forced to become a geotechnical engineer of your own property. You must constantly monitor retaining walls, hillside drainage culverts, and soil saturation levels.
And you must also manage the biosphere directly above your roof.
Trees.
The tree.
People pay a premium to live in the woods until a severe winter windstorm hits. Then, those massive 150-foot Douglas firs surrounding the house stop looking like majestic scenery and start looking like 10,000-pound kinetic weapons aimed at your bedroom.
It's a real fear.
The broker notes the necessity of hiring arborists for continuous forest health assessments on your own property.
And the final, most modern burden is the financial math of the urban wildland interface.
The insurance.
Because these custom homes are embedded within millions of board feet of highly flammable timber on steep slopes with narrow, single-lane access roads that fire engines struggle to navigate, the insurance actuaries are panicking.
I can imagine.
The broker explicitly warns buyers about skyrocketing, sometimes unattainable, wildfire insurance premiums.
It redefines the concept of homeownership. You aren't just buying real estate, you are buying a dynamic adversarial relationship with Chuckanut Mountain.
Which is why the broker's candor is so valuable. He states he would rather force a client to make a clear-eyed, fully informed decision and lose a sale than sell an illusion that collapses during the first winter storm.
That's real integrity.
He uses the friction of Larrabee State Park to shatter the social media fantasy of effortless wilderness living.
It is a masterclass in expectation management, and it brings our entire deep dive full circle. We started in 1915 with Frances Larrabee having her family's name politically strapped to a 20-acre roadside pullout so early automobiles could cool their engines.
We track the manual labor of the 1930s WPA carving an underpass through solid rock.
We navigated the 35-year bureaucratic nightmare of fighting a massive railroad conglomerate for the right to build a pedestrian bridge to Clayton Beach.
We analyzed the unforgiving mathematics of the lunar tides, where the exact same ocean movement that reveals a hidden ecosystem of sea stars simultaneously drains a boat launch into a useless mudflat.
We exposed the jarring reality of industrial logging equipment operating adjacent to hikers searching for serenity.
And we explored the sheer logistical exhaustion of 9-month camping waitlists and lethal highway parking scenarios.
It proves that true local knowledge isn't about knowing where the prettiest view is. It's about understanding the mechanics of the mud, the traffic, and the tides. When you understand the friction, the landscape stops being a disappointing inconvenience and starts being a legible, predictable system.
The difficulty doesn't ruin the experience. It validates it. You engage with the mountain on its terms, not yours.
And as we close the book on Larrabee State Park, that idea of difficulty leads to a lingering question I want to leave you with. We have watched this specific patch of coastal forest evolve to handle our modern affection. We bored tunnels in the 30s, built million-dollar overpasses in the 2020s, and deployed strict digital reservation systems, all just to manage the overwhelming volume of human desire to be near the water.
We've done so much to accommodate it.
It makes you wonder, are we destined to eventually over-engineer our wild spaces until the wildness is gone entirely? Or does the friction we talked about today, the disappearing boat ramps, the exhausting climbs, the terrifying parking, the venomous shellfish, does that friction actually serve as a vital, necessary immune system for the landscape?
A filter.
Exactly. Does the sheer difficulty of the park act as a natural filter that protects its magic from being completely consumed? Take a look at the wildest place near your own home. Is the fact that it's difficult to reach actually the very thing keeping it alive?